The Murthy Law Firm has been clarifying U.S. immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Hello, I am Sheila Murthy, President and CEO of the Murthy Law Firm. I'm so honored that you can join us for today's discussion on F-1 visas and employment options for students in the United States. Joining me for today's discussion are a couple of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, attorney Anna Stepanova and Lori Haas. For those who may be familiar, Anna has been with the firm close to 20 years. She's an assistant managing attorney. She's a brilliant lawyer and colleague. And for all things connected with the F-1 student issues, I have no hesitation in getting her to issue clarifications or explain complex issues, because in her former life, over 20 years ago or 25 years ago, she was an international student advisor or designated school official, DSO, as they call them today under U.S. immigration law. Joining me also is Lori Haas, who has similarly had, I think, over 20 years of experience working with the local government in the state of Maryland, brilliant, smart, caring lawyer, so who's familiar with this and who's now focusing a lot on F-1 student-related issues. So with that brief introduction, and I, of course, for those who may not be familiar, I'm Sheila Murthy, president, founder, and CEO of the Murthy Law Firm. Started the firm 30 years, yoo-hoo, 30-year celebration of the Murthy Law Firm this year in 2024. And our goal and our whole mission, vision, and values and statement is about educating, empowering, and enlightening employers, employees, and families so they understand complex issues of immigration law and holding their hands and guiding them through the very complex immigration law process. So getting right to the topic of student issues, as many of you know, most foreign nationals utilize the F-1 status to study in the U.S. Many of you on the call probably have used F-1 to pursue a master's degree or a bachelor's degree in the U.S. And so we will provide an overview of F-1, the visa status, with a primary focus on what are the limited employment options that F-1 students could utilize here. So a quick overview, the F-1 program is managed by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and in ICE there is a subgroup, if you will, called the SEVP, or the Student and Exchange Visitor Program. It is monitored using the web-based SEVIS, which is the Student and Exchange Visitor Information System. So the SEVIS record is controlled by the school's DSO, or designated school official. As you know, I just described Anna as having held that role before. So it's critical that an F-1 student maintains ongoing communication with the DSO while they're pursuing their bachelor's or master's degree or PhD program or postdoc, et cetera, right? F-1 requires full-time enrollment in an academic program at an SEVP-certified institution, which, by the way, also includes English language programs. The F-1 visa is most commonly used in higher education, but believe it or not, students even in high school are allowed to use it to attend K-12, but it is not available for public schools from the kindergarten through the 8th grade. Can only be used for 12 months of either public high school, but in order for the student to do that, the student has to pay for the full cost of tuition or attendance. Again, don't get confused with age 4 kids and other people, because they'll be like, I didn't pay for my kid's tuition. Yes, but if they were on F-1, then you would have to do that. So with that, I'm going to invite my esteemed colleague, Anna, to jump in to describe a little bit more about the quick overview on F-1s. Anna, take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, Sheila, and thank you for the great introduction. I'm glad to be there and present with you and Lori. So just to continue with the overview of the F-1 visa program. As many people know, it's a non-immigrant, strictly non-immigrant visa category, which means that the students are required to establish ties to their home country when they apply for either a visa FOIL at a U.S. consulate abroad, or when they apply for a change of status from within the U.S. However, recently, and that is something that we as immigration attorneys who focus on this type of issue were very excited about, USCIS has recently updated their policy manual, which says now that even if an F-1 holder has a green card case that they start themselves or their employer start or a family green card case, it does not disqualify them from establishing non-immigrant intent. So that's a great benefit now that we
absolutely
can use for the benefit
very
of
exciting.
Our clients.
Very exciting news. Yes, thank you, Anna.
Sure. And another point that kind of also belongs to the general overview. This is something that F-1 applicants are all required to show. This is the financial ability to pay the bills, to pay tuition, to pay room and board, all of the fees and all of the other expenses that are normally required for somebody to be able to attend the school. But the student in this case does not have to show that they have the money on hand to last the entire program of study. They would only be required to show that they have enough to attend the first year, and then after that, that they have a source of financial resources to cover their subsequent years during the program. And also, when a student is coming to the U.S. from abroad for the first time, they are able to enter the U.S. up to 30 days before the start of their program. That's a regulatory benefit that they have. There is nothing similar in the regulation for those who apply for change of status, but USCIS has adopted that requirement for travel, and they also allow students who apply for change of status to have a gap between the end date of their previous status and the requested start date, which would be the start date of their program of study as noted on their form I-20. Also something that is beneficial for students, and this is not available to any other category.
Thank you so much, Anna. Great overview. And I know that the next most common issue, whether you're a student or the employer wanting to hire a student, either during or before or after graduation, is the maintenance of status for F-1 students, which of course is a fairly, you know, complex issue. So I'm going to invite Laurie to maybe share a little bit of background and information on that topic. Laurie?
Thank you, Sheila. So once a student is in F-1 status, either they've traveled from abroad or they've changed their status in the United States, they want to make sure that they continue to abide by the enrollment and reporting requirements for the F-1 visa. So there are numerous rules that they're going to need to follow. And, you know, as we mentioned, the DSO at the student school is going to control their CVIS record. And the DSO at the, is going to be the one to make a determination as to whether or not there has been a CVIS violation or a status violation that would cause the student's CVIS record to be terminated. So generally, in order to continue to maintain F-1 status, the student needs to continue to make normal progress in their program of study and should maintain a full-time course load. So this is the primary requirement. In order to take a reduced course load, which may be authorized in certain situations, however, it needs to be authorized prior to enrollment. A student cannot simply take a reduced course load without prior authorization, and that authorization would come from their DSO. So staying in touch with their DSO and clearly communicating, you know, this aspect is going to be very important for students. You know, F1 students must also receive approval from their DSO prior to traveling abroad and should not travel outside the U.S. for more than 5 months. And that is unless they're participating in authorized study abroad program. Students are also required to maintain up-to-date records with their DSO, and this might just even include notifying the school of any address changes. There are a number of other updates that might happen. You're going to want to, you know, the student is going to want to make sure that they, you know, report this to their DSO. Now, if a student fails to maintain status, the DSO will terminate their CBIS record. And the student should engage with, you know, a qualified immigration attorney to determine options to regain their F1 status. But most importantly, students should take care to ensure that any employment that they engage in is authorized under the program. So whether or not the student has maintained their status is going to kind of spill into any number of areas that, that come after being an F1 status. So it's a very important issue to take seriously.
Thank you so much, Laurie. And to Laurie's point about ensuring that any employment that the student engages in is authorized under the program, there are just very few, they're not a million options, there are a handful of options, so let's just briefly go over them. The first one, of course, is what we refer to as on-campus employment. The second is what is the, known as CPT, or Curricular Practical Training. And the third, which many of you may be familiar with, is the OPT, Optional Practical Training. There is both pre-OPT or pre- and post-completion, prior to completing the program and post-completion OPT, right? And some people, of course, then refer to the STEM OPT as separate from all of these. But there's also a couple of other classifications available, including, for example, employment authorization for students who may experience severe economic hardship and special student relief programs for students from certain countries, as well as certain employment sponsored by certain international organizations. Again, these are not the norm. These are somewhat rare, and we are not going to be having the time to discuss these in detail. So if it applies to you, you're certainly welcome to contact us at the Murthy Law Firm. Employment authorized because of severe economic hardship. So generally an F1 student, other than a student either from Mexico or Canada, those are sometimes border commuter students, as we refer to them sometimes as, who end up experiencing severe unforeseen economic necessity may apply to the USCIS for what they refer to as off-campus work authorization. It's part-time off-campus, but it's eligible only after 1 year of full-time study in the U.S. on F1 status, right? So after the full 1 year of study. And then the second option, like we said, is the Special Student Relief Program, which is based on on-campus economic hardship. Employment categories are now for citizens of Afghanistan, Myanmar or Burma, Cameroon, Ethiopia, Haiti, Hong Kong, Somalia, Southern Sudan, Ukraine, Venezuela, and Yemen. And then the employment sponsored by international organizations is actually in the Code of Federal Regulations, or CFR. It's 24.214.2 F9 little 3 little i's, right? So the student could apply for an EAD, Employment Authorization Document, to work in an internship, to work in an internship program with a recognized international organization within the meaning of the International Organization Immunities Act. And there's no, believe it or not, there's no waiting period for that. So they, I guess, want to encourage international employment by international organizations. So next, we're going to have Anna talk about the hot topic of on-campus employment for these students. Anna?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the first type of employment that you, Sheila, mentioned in the previous segment when you introduced all types of employment. And on-campus employment is often times overlooked for some reason. But this is a great benefit, and it's something that we call incident to status, which means that this is probably just one type of employment available to F1 students that does not require a special permission. But there are still some rules that you have to follow. So F1 students are generally permitted to work part-time on the premises of the school that issued the I-20 without any notation on their I-20, without applying to anybody, and there is no wait time. They can immediately start working once they start their program of study. But it has to be part-time, and they could only work full-time during the scheduled breaks in the school year, which is typically winter break and summer break. So what is also something to look for? As I said, it has to be on the school premises. But the school premises would also include something that would be considered to be an educationally affiliated off-campus location. And this entity would be associated with the school's established curriculum or be a part of contractually funded research projects at the postgraduate level. Don't underestimate and overthink, you know, whether or not it's something that is affiliated, not affiliated. Go to the DSO. They usually have this information available, and sometimes you may be surprised. Some entity where you would want to work, like at a lab or something that is affiliated with the school, would still be considered to be on campus. But on the flip side, something that's physically located on campus, like a construction site, for example, that would not be considered to be available for this type of employment because it doesn't strictly benefit or provide services to the students. So you wouldn't be able to work for the construction company that is building something on campus. Also, it would have to be, something that is, as I said already, affiliated. So could be either located on campus or off campus, but you have to look for the kind of the goal of that entity and their mission. So whenever in doubt, it would be a good idea to just ask your DSO.
Great. Thank you very much, Anna. So next, let's touch upon the curricular practical training, or CPT, and I'm going to invite Laurie to talk a little bit about that.
Thanks, Sheila. This is the second type of employment that we talk about in the F1 context. And CPT is the type of curricular practical training needs to be authorized by your DSO before the F1 student can participate in it. And but notably, it does not require USCIS application for employment authorization. So that's a big step that students don't need to go through in order to have this as an option. In order for students to receive CPT, and meaning that they the DSO would need to give them authorization, the training and the employment associated with that training must be an integral part of an established curriculum and directly related to the student's major area of study. So these terms are, defined by regulation, and SCVP has advised that CPT must be an integral to the student's program of study when an employer formally authorized by the school through a cooperative agreement. So those are a lot of words. We need to look at the regulation to kind of maybe get a better understanding at this. And the regulation that we look at is 8 CFR, Code of Federal Regulations, 214.2 F10i. And in that regulation, we, see exactly what is required. And it states, curricular practical training is defined to be the alternative work, study, internship, cooperative education, or any type of required internship or practicum that is offered by sponsors through cooperative agreements with the school. So that's a lot of words. It could be somewhat, complicated. In our work, we have noted that this regulation and, kind of how it's defined is inconsistent with ICE or U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and their guidance. And their guidance is consistent with established interpretation and practice regarding CPT documentation. So that essentially states that, and for our practice, for our purposes, we follow that CPT requires a signed cooperative agreement or a letter from your employer. Best practice from, that we enlist is a formal cooperative agreement detailing the offered position and their job duties to determine whether it meets the requirements in achieving the school's curriculum and goals. If a formal cooperative agreement is not obtainable, then it's best to obtain a letter from the employer that can confirm the cooperation to meet the curriculum goals.
Right. So I just wanted to jump in. Thank you, Lori, and add something about so-called day one CPT that people are talking about. There is no such term. It's not a legal term, day one CPT. But what people refer to when they say it is when they're able to start CPT day one, just from the start of their program of study, which generally is not available because the general rule says that you have to be lawfully enrolled on a full-time basis at an SCVP-approved college, university, conservatory, or seminary for one full academic year before you would become eligible to apply for CPT and receive authorization to engage in this type of employment. But the exception to the rule is when the program of study specifically requires that the student start working in an internship or something that would involve a practical application of their academic study from day one. And if this, if your program does have this requirement, then the general rule that prohibits CPT during the first full academic year does not apply. So this is what people mean when they say day one CPT school. Well, it's not really a designation for a school. It just means that that school has programs that have this requirement to graduate to engage in first year practicum or an internship. Also, the CPT would not be available to any students in English language training programs. And you would also need to know that 12 months of full-time CPT affects your eligibility for optional practical training. Part-time OPT, I'm sorry, part-time CPT does not affect that. So you could be engaging in part-time CPT for 4 years or longer, 2 years, 3 years or longer, and you would still be eligible for OPT. But 12 months of full-time CPT would make you ineligible for OPT after you graduate. But, if your goal is not to apply for OPT, then full-time CPT is not limited by itself. It's only limited if you still want to preserve the ability to apply for optional practical training.
Thank you, Anna. So as you can see, there are certain nuances, and thank you for explaining what day one CPT means, because everybody says, I want day one CPT. I'm going to join a university that does day one CPT. So thank you for explaining that, how that works and the eligibility. And one of the questions I know that we get asked and that you might, so when you just mentioned that the use of the 12 months of full-time CPT affects the eligibility for optional practical training at the same educational level, and there's no limit during the school term, so potentially could this student argue a particular university, or a student, Anna, could they person just argue hey, I only did, let's say, 30 hours, not 40 hours. So it's not full time. So then they could still be eligible for the one full year of OPT after they graduate?
Yes. Yes. So as long as it qualifies the student for, you know, the number of hours that they work per week would be considered to be part-time, there is no effect on OPT, regardless of the length of time that they engage in this employment.
Wonderful. Great. So I'm sure people have already been taking advantage of it and will continue to take advantage of that option for exactly the reasons as you mentioned. So the next topic that we want to touch upon, of course, is OPT or optional practical training. And as most of you know, that is something that is available after, generally, it could be pre or post completion, as you know. It is recommended by the school, the university's DSO, and it requires the student to file the I-765 application to receive the EAD card or the employment authorization document. Again, the OPT employment has to be related to the student's program of study. It's only available after the student has completed 1 year of academic study, and it's limited to 12 months per academic level. So if you change to, so if you got 12 months for your bachelor's, you can get 12 more months for master's and 12 months for PhD, because sometimes a person will complete one master's and jump to a second and not realize that they don't get an additional 12 months OPT. It's not after each degree, but each educational level. The 1 year of academic study does not have to be in F1 status, which is an interesting twist on it, because this, if the child, for example, is on H4 status, then switches to F1, they still will be able to take advantage of the OPT. So as we mentioned earlier, there are two types of OPT, pre and post completion, right? So the pre-completion can be approved for full-time when the school is not in session, can be for full-time, while any period of pre-completion OPT will be deducted from the authorized post-completion OPT, and part-time is deducted. So this is a different rule than what Anna just went over regarding the CPT. This is the optional practical training. So in this, if you did the certain amount of time, 6 months part-time, then it's 3 months, right? Or 1 year, then it's 50%, so you'll then only get the balance of time. But you have to work at least 20 hours per week during post-completion OPT. The pre-completion doesn't have that requirement. And any grant of OPT is pretty much a use it or lose it. So if the student, for example, is given 12 months but decides I'm only going to use 3 months because I got selected in the H-1 lottery and now I've switched my status, they are not able to take advantage of the additional OPT time at the same educational level. The next point, of course, is unpaid training is allowed during the first year of OPT, but it cannot and should not violate labor laws in the U.S. So that's very important, because many people say, oh, I don't, but then it can't be where the employer is kind of taking advantage of people. It has to be legitimate, bona fide, and all of those things. And during post-completion OPT, the student is limited to 90 days of unemployment during the first, you know, the first 12 months of that OPT. And in the first 12 months of that OPT, post-completion OPT, self-employment, including multiple employers, are allowed basically do that kind of work. Any changes in employment must be reported within 10 days. A student can apply for OPT up to 90 days before the end of the program and 60 days after the program end date. So it's a very short window that you have, and the student must submit the OPT application within 30 days of the DSO's recommendation for OPT and CEVA status, right? So it's a lot of little rules. Unfortunately, students often run against it, get into trouble, try to ask for exceptions, but there's really no, like, exception allowed under the law. It's not like hardship, loops, whatever. It's very, very difficult. So it's very important to monitor it and have somebody check on it. So I'm going to invite, I guess, Anna to talk a little bit about STEM extension after the OPT. Anna?
All right. So for the sake of time, just to be mindful of it, I'd like just to talk about and to go over some highlights of STEM extension LPT, because this is a topic in itself. We can spend a couple of hours maybe discussing STEM LPT, and that would still not be enough. So highlights, it's a 24-month extension. You have to apply before the first year LPT ends, so that USCIS has to accept it. They can. It's a bright line rule. Sometimes we have calls with people who say, "Well, my STEM LPT was denied. I was one day late." Well, it's not worth it filing a motion, because that's they don't have any discretion to waive that requirement. So it's very important that you file it on time. And it also has to be filed within 60 days of the DSO making STEM OPT recommendation and CVIS. STEM OPT also requires something that is not a requirement for the first year OPT, and that's a form I-983 that has to be completed by both the employer and the employee, and it doesn't get filed with USCIS. But it is sent to the DSO at the employee school, where the DSO inputs all of the information which the form contains, which is where the work is going to be held, who the employer is, and so on and so forth. So this is very important that all of the information that goes on the form is accurate, because when the DSO puts it in CVIS, this is what USCIS will be looking at when they are making a decision on the student's STEM OPT application. All right. So the employer signs the I-983 under the penalty of perjury, and they're making certain attestations that they have sufficient resources and trained personnel available to provide the training. And then they would also have to make an attestation that they will not replace a full or part-time, temporary or permanent U.S. workers. And the opportunity helps the student attain his or her training objective. So they have to specify how this would enhance the academic training received by the student during the course of study. So the other requirement is that the employer is registered with the E-Verify program with the government. Again, it's also a bright line rule. There are no waivers, no exceptions to it, and the student becomes subject to the STEM OPT requirements, including the this one, when their first year OPT ends, even if the STEM OPT is still pending. So the day after the end of the first year OPT, then they must be working for the E-Verify company. So that's also very important, because sometimes students are not aware of the requirement, or they confuse it with the employer tax ID number. So that's important to make sure that the employer is registered with E-Verify. There are some reporting requirements, and there are some other requirements that does not apply to first year OPT. So as I said in the beginning, this is a lot of information which would not be possible to go over in a lot of detail during this call or during this teleconference. So if you have any questions whatsoever, we offer great services both to the company and to the employee, just kind of help them navigate very complex rules that are associated with STEM OPT.
Thank you, Anna. Extension. So I guess we're going to very, very briefly have Laurie maybe touch upon STEM OPT reporting requirements. I know it's like we're running a little short on time. Okay, great. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, we can give an overview so you can at least be alerted to if there are any issues that you need to seek more guidance on. And yeah, as we've kind of led on, you know, being on STEM OBT is much more onerous, perhaps. And so there are a number of reporting requirements that you want to make sure that you're aware of, and they apply both to the employer and the F1 students. So we look to kind of four distinct reporting requirements. The first one being a six-month validation requirement. So what that means is that the student must confirm to the DSO their biographical, residential, and employment information every 6 months. The second is referred to as a self-evaluation, and that refers to the requirement that the student must provide a progress of practical training to the DSO on an annual basis using the form I-983, and that's the form that the employee we just went over, the training form. And a tip that we often give to our clients is to have a student keep a journal of the training progress, which can be used for reporting purposes later on. So this is something that they'll keep as they go, and it makes this reporting requirement a little bit easier and reliable. Fourth requirement is the student employer must report any changes in the employment status. And then fourth, a student employer must report any material changes in the student's formal training program to the DSO, also using the form I-983. And this might include a different wage level, a new work site, et cetera. After knowing those requirements, we want to make sure that it's noted that an F1 student can be unemployed for an additional 60 days while on STEM OPT extension without falling out of status. So if they're on OPT and then STEM OPT, it will be 150 days total in the aggregate. And employers have to report terminations and resignations within 5 business days. I was going to say that those are the reporting requirements that employers and F1 students want to make sure that they're aware of.
Thank you, Laurie. So when Laurie was talking about the student and employer, both have these reporting requirements. There's also, believe it or not, 2 STEM OPT extensions possible in one lifetime. All right. So, but the second STEM extension has to be based on a degree at a higher educational level, so a bachelor's to master's or master's to PhD, et cetera. And the student can apply for the STEM OPT extension based on a prior STEM degree earned within the past 10 years, but needs to have the initial OPT available. So if someone says, I used my 12-month OPT, but never used my STEM OPT, that's a problem because you're not going to get another 12 months F1 OPT for the same educational level. So now you can't get the STEM OPT based on the prior degree, even though you didn't use it. But if it's another new degree and you get the 12 months, then you could try for the STEM OPT, right? So you have, for example, a bachelor's in computer science, you later enroll in non-STEM MS degree, can get the STEM OPT based on the original prior. So it's a use it or lose it, as we said earlier. If you're planning to obtain a second degree at the same level, do not ask for the full 12 months of OPT, keep some of it aside, so you might be able to use it, tack it on for your next second master's degree, for example, in the same level of education, to be able to take advantage of the STEM OPT part of it. And a couple of final points that I think we're going to try to quickly round out is to have maybe Anna talk briefly about traveling during the OPT and the STEM OPT timeframes, and then Laurie just kind of talking about the CAP-GAP issue changing to H-1B status, but then we'll try to conclude because we're very mindful of our time-related issues. So Anna and then Laurie, go ahead.
All right, very quickly. You can travel as a student during OPT, and generally speaking, it's the most conservative approach. And the last riskier option is to make sure that you have an I-20 signed by the DSO for travel and the approved
OPT with the EAD. Can you travel during the pendency of the OPT? Right now, yes, this rule has changed a few times in the past, but right now it's more flexible. You can travel, but just remember that Customs and Border Protection has a lot of discretion, so it has to be taken with a lot of caution. And then keep in mind the unemployment limits. So when you travel, if it's not because the employer wants you to go on a trip, on a business trip, and that's why you travel, then the time spent abroad would be counted towards unemployment maximum that Laura just mentioned. And also during travel during cab gap, some people ask about that, can only travel after the H-1B is approved. You cannot travel and return on cab gap. Why? Well, because in that case, the departure from the U.S. will result in the abandonment of the H-1B petition, change of status, not the petition itself, but the change of status part of it, and then cab gap is no longer applicable. So these are the most important rules for travel.
Lori, cap gap issue.
Sure, thank you. Thanks, Sheila. So Anna mentioned cap gap, and what that means is it's a benefit to an F-1 student who has been on OPT and they have a cap H-1B petition that's been filed for them. So it allows the F-1 student with a pending or approved cap H-1B petition with an accompanying change of status request to continue on F-1 until October 1st. So to benefit from this cap gap employment authorization, the change of status must be filed prior to the end of the current OPT. With this, the student can get an I-20 to evidence the cap gap employment authorization, and it terminates if the H-1B is denied or withdrawn prior to October 1st. So if the student is not on OPT, they can still benefit from a cap gap change of status is filed prior to the end of the 60-day grace period, but cannot work. But they can stay in the United States. So this is a benefit to the F-1 student with a pending or approved cap H-1B petition.
Wonderful. Thank you, Lori. Thank you, Anna. As you can see from this discussion, there are so many nuances pertaining to student-related issues, and we've literally touched like the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. We certainly have the bandwidth and the ability in the incredible talent from my brilliant colleagues, Anna and Lori, as you heard them talk about these issues, because they deal with these sorts of issues regularly on a routine basis. So if you are an employer of a person, a student on F-1 status, you're a student, you're a family member, please don't hesitate to contact us at the Murthy Law Firm because we deal with these issues. And then, of course, the transition from F-1 to H-1B and then the green card, the perm, complex issues, simple issues, regular issues. You don't have complex issues if you come to a good firm because prevention is always cheaper than cure, and you won't need to be scurrying around trying to file appeals and motions and all of that. If you use our firm to file it properly in the first place, or a good lawyer that knew what they were doing, hopefully in majority of the cases. So on behalf of myself, Sheila Murthy, on behalf of Anna Stepanova, Lori Haas, and all of us at the Murthy Law Firm, we want to wish you a happy spring around the corner. We want to thank you for taking time to join us today. And we look forward to helping you, your families, your employees, your coworkers, your friends on all matters pertaining to U.S. immigration law. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful afternoon.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.